This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode number 22 of the Beersmith Home Brewing Show. We're doing a session on session beers this week with Mike Tonsmeyer. Looking forward to that. Before we jump into that, I'm happy to say we have our first sponsor for the Beersmith podcast. We are very happy that our sponsor is More Beer, one of the largest online suppliers of equipment and brewing ingredients. Now, I personally ordered from More Beer myself before, and we also had Chris Graham, who is one of the major partners of More Beer, on episode 19, talking about saving money. So if you like to order ingredients or equipment online, and you want to let them know how much you appreciate their support, just go to beersmith.com/morebeer. That's beersmith.com/morebeer. And use the links there to place your next order. You can order anything in their entire catalog, and they'll donate a portion back to us to support the podcast, the blog, the newsletter, and all the other things that we do here at Beersmith. We love our first sponsor. Please go to beersmith.com/morebeer and show your support. Second announcement I have is we have an update for Beersmith 2 coming. It's going to come around the end of September, so keep an eye out for that. And now let's jump into this week's episode. This week, my guest on the show is Mike Tonsmeyer, a.k.a. The Mad Fermentationist, who runs a blog at themadfermentationist.com. Mike appeared before as a guest way back on episode number 8 of the Beersmith podcast, which was on historical brewing techniques. Mike, it's fantastic to have you back on the show.
It's great to be back on the show. I just love talking beer, and I'm really looking forward to talking about low-gravity beers and session beers and all sorts of stuff.
Well, thanks, Mike. Yeah, as Mike points out, today we're going to talk about session beers, or what a lot of people call low-gravity beers. Now, Mike, the first question I have for you is pretty obvious. Why would anybody want to really brew a low-gravity beer? You know, most of us define a low-gravity beer as, say, 3, 4% or something like that. Why would you want to go that low or even go lower for a beer?
I think there's a lot of different people who have different reasons for doing it. So the classic reason is so you can drink more. I think, like a lot of people, I'd rather have two beers than one. And if I can have two pints of a beer and still be able to cook dinner, I think that's a pretty good deal compared to having, you know, 8 ounces of an imperial stout or barley wine. And, you know, that being it for the night, why not, you know, have something that's low enough alcohol that you can just keep drinking it, keep enjoying it. As you talk to your friends, as you cook dinner, as you brew a beer, anything like that.
I know a lot of people enjoy these on a seasonal basis too, don't they?
Yeah, and certainly classically these would be sort of summertime drinking beers. I certainly get more of a desire to knock back a couple of pints of something cold when it's 90 degrees out rather than the cold winter night, you know, sitting in front of the fire, when maybe you do want to be sipping on something that's a little more powerful. That's going to take a little bit, you know, more, you know, time to drink and time to enjoy. And these beers are much easier to drink. I mean, lower alcohol, less aggressive bitterness, less aggressive flavors. So it's the sort of thing that you can sort of drink a little bit more, stay hydrated, that sort of thing. They're also really cheap to brew, since you're using, in often cases, half the ingredients, half the hops, half the malt. Really cheap beers to brew. Other people might choose them because they're lower in calories. Certainly a valid reason. I certainly, like many homebrewers, probably could cut back on the calories from beer once in a while.
So some people refer to these as session beers, and that term has sort of an interesting history. Can you talk to us a little bit about where the term session beer comes from?
Well, it's one of those terms. It's just this great word that is sort of caught on. There's still some sort of debate over exactly where it came from. It's certainly an English term. Most people agree that it had something to do with the drinking session. So, you know, beer you could drink over a couple of hours. There's one theory that it got the term from a 4-hour block of time that shell producers during World War I got to do their drinking. No one's exactly sure.
Did you say shell producers?
I believe it's like bombing shells, I guess.
Like they're drinking at lunchtime and building armament here.
You know, I think this is sort of the classic thing that, you know, before water, and this is not necessarily World War I, but even before that, beer was pretty much all anyone drank, and so I mean table beers that were 1 or even 2% alcohol were often a large part of what even children drank. So you have to have a beer that's at this low, you know, level where you can keep drinking it and not get completely trashed. So while it was originally this English term that, you know, mostly bitters, milds, those sorts of things, you know, some brown ales, some robust porters, things like that. In America, particularly among craft brew aficionados and homebrewers, it now just sort of means any kind of beer that you could drink a lot of, so lower alcohol. But part of that, too, is that the flavor is something that you'd want to drink a lot of. You aren't going to get your palate worn out. So, for example, while a lambic might be 4.5 or even lower alcohol, I think most people wouldn't call it a session beer because I mean, as much as I love sour beers, and I do love sour beers, they aren't necessarily the sort of thing that I'd want to be drinking 5, 6, 7, 8 pints of in a night. Because I mean, between your stomach and just the flavor, you're just going to be overwhelming. So normally they're going to be things maybe a little more on the malty side, although there's certainly some hoppier and some, you know, some Belgian session beers that are, you know, different characters. But that's about session ale at the moment.
Now, when you start out designing a low gravity beer, do you tend to target a certain beer style? I mean, are there some styles that fit in better with session beers than others?
Well, I guess the question is, do you want to brew to an established BJCP style? So if you are looking to brew something that still fits within the style and fits within the guidelines, you still have loads of, you know, choices. Mm-hmm. Other than bitter and mild and brown ale and sort of the classic English ones, Guinness, the Irish dry stouts is another classic example. I was never
going to lie. How much is Guinness roughly?
It's about 3.2, I think, percent alcohol.
Yeah, the draft version. I know it's in low threes, so that sounds about right.
It's somewhere around there, and that's despite the fact that people always sort of refer to it as this, you know, meal in a glass or something. It has fewer calories and less alcohol than Bud Light. And you can even do lagers and something like a Pilsner or a Helles or a Dunkel. Great examples of session beers. I mean, every culture has their own. For the Belgians, it would be, say, a Belgian pale ale, maybe a low-gravity saison, maybe a wit, something like that. In America, we've gotten our session ales a little bit bigger. Pale ales, even the, you know, the sort of pale ales that end up being 5 or 5.5%, a lot of Americans refer to as session ales. Your other option is you can sort of sessionize another style. So you could take... maybe a style like an oatmeal stout or a style like an IPA, and then lower the gravity, but trying to keep sort of the general character of the style the same. So, for example, at the moment I'm drinking a glass of IPA. I call it IPA. It's about 2% alcohol, 2.1%, but I really loaded it up on the finishing hop. So it's only about 30 or 35 IBUs. But with similar finishing and dry hopping to an IPA, so it still has that really big hop aroma. And even at 30 or 35 IBUs, it still tastes as bitter, even more bitter maybe than a lot of IPAs, because there isn't as much malt there to back it up. Mm-hmm. Sessionizing doesn't really work for styles where your alcohol is sort of an integral part of the style, like a barley wine, maybe a Belgian triple, an imperial stout. These are styles where when you scale them down, they just end up tasting like another style. I mean, a smaller barley wine might be an ESB, a smaller triple might be a Belgian pale, a smaller imperial stout is just going to be a smaller stout. And you can do some things, you know, maybe go a little bit heavier on some dark crystal malt, something like that, a little bit heavier on the roasted malt than you might need with a stout, and get a similar sort of balance, but really it's not going to taste very much like the target style.
So what's the difference between, say, a low-gravity beer and a low-calorie beer? I mean, you mentioned Bud Light a minute ago. What's the difference between, say, a Bud Light and a session beer?
There's actually, I mean, Bud Light is a session beer for some people. I mean, that's the sort of beer that, you know, people go buy a bucket of Bud Light at some bar and go through, you know, 8 or 9 of them. That's just one example of a session beer, though. White beers tend to be, the main goal there is fewer calories, really light, almost non-existent flavor. For a session beer, you're going to have a little bit more body, a little bit more mouthfeel, more flavor. Brewers do things to try to get as much flavor as they can into the beer. So whereas a Bud Light or something like that, people are going to, because it doesn't taste, you know, taste very strong, session beers people go to because they still have a lot of the great character that they love in other styles of beer, but just less alcohol. And the lower calories is almost just sort of a byproduct of the fact that alcohols have calories. If you have less alcohol, you're going to have less calories. But really, in the end, the Bud Light is just sort of the session beer version, or the even more session-y version of American macro lagers like Budweiser and Miller and whatnot. And in a way, that's what these session ales are. They're just sort of the lighter, more drinkable versions of the styles that craft brewers and home brewers love.
So when you're sitting down to design a beer, like a session beer, let's start with a grain bill. What do you just scale a grain bill down to make a lower alcohol beer, or do you do something different?
You know, that would certainly be a really good place to start. Normally, recipes scale in percentages pretty well. You're going to want to oftentimes though boost up the amount of specialty malts. Session beers, low alcohol beers tend to be a little bit on the thin side. Mm-hmm. So raising the percentage of caramel malts, crystal malts, those sorts of things is generally a good idea. For something like a stout, you might want to go a little bit higher than you normally would on the roasted malts. Otherwise, if you just scale them down linearly, you can end up with a beer that's pretty pale, that that doesn't have as much roast character as you want. For something like that, you might want to consider, instead of just using, you know, more roasted barley or something like that, subbing in some craft special, a dehusked dark malt that's going to give you more color and some of those chocolate and coffee flavors, but without as much roast. When you're scaling down the base malt, since you've got less sugar left over, less of that, you know, dextrins and those sorts of things, it's a little bit harder to balance out really strong things like roasted bitterness. I would definitely consider if it's a recipe that has some sort of refined sugar, either corn sugar, table sugar, candy sugar, and even sort of the unrefined sugars, you know, candy syrups, the dark candy syrups, or any of those, going less on them. The refined sugars have a tendency to ferment out almost completely.
Right.
And so you're really not getting any flavor. And that's really, you should be making all of your decisions on a beer like this on how you can maximize the flavor that you're getting into the beer.
Right, because you don't want it to taste too thin, right?
Exactly. There is some history with some of the unrefined cane sugars in milds, but I would just suggest, you know, using it very judiciously, you know, minimal amount just to get the flavor you're looking for, rather than using maybe a brown sugar that has a little bit of molasses character, using one of the really darker ones that you might get from a specialty store. For even adding more body and mouthfeel, you might consider using some unmalted grains, particularly things like oats and rye. They have this compound called beta-glucan that really gives you that thick, syrupy mouthfeel, which if you overdo it, say more than 10 or 15% in a small beer, might be a little bit too thick. But it's a great way to add body without making a beer sweeter, because that's really not what you want. You don't want these beers to be sweet, because that's not going to be something you want to drink a lot of. You're aiming for balance. You're aiming for something you're going to be able to drink a lot of. Another great trick for getting a lot of flavor into a beer is using a base malt that's going to give you a lot of character. So rather than using just regular old American two-row, maybe getting some Maris Otter, yeah, you know, good English toasted malt, Vienna, Munich, dark wheat maybe. There and now there are a lot of sort of interesting malts popping up. I just got a sack of pale malt from a small new maltster in Massachusetts called Valley Malt. And a lot of these weird German malts and Belgian malts are starting to be available at homebrew stores to have a bigger selection. Definitely worth checking out rather than just trying to dump specialty malts in to sort of fake a character. Get something that's really going to boost that character up for you.
Okay, so that covers sort of the malt side of things. What about bitterness? You obviously got you talked a minute ago about how important it is to match up the maltiness and the bitterness, so you get something that's very drinkable. How does hops and bitterness change as you scale a beer down?
You know, I'm not sure if it was Ray Daniels in Design Great Beers who came up with this concept, or if he was just borrowing it from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But the ratio of the bitterness units of the IBUs to the gravity.
Yeah, he calls it the bitterness ratio. I think Ray Daniels does, at least. I don't think he came up with it. If you go back, yeah. I think if you go back 100 years, I heard that, you know, they have, the English were using, you know, pounds per keg, for example.
Exactly. At the very least, he popularized this particular measure. And I don't believe that this is necessarily the perfect, you know, tool, but I think it gives you an idea. If you've got, say, for example, the IPA I was talking about, that maybe you would make a beer that was starting at 1.060 with 60 IBUs. So that's mm-hmm. about a 1-to-1 ratio of gravity points to bitterness. If you want to scale that down to, say, 1030, you'd want about 30 IBUs, so you'd want to keep that ratio similar. Same way if you had a beer maybe that was starting at 1050 with 25 IBUs, there'd be 2 gravity points for every 1 IBU. So similar idea, you'd want to keep that ratio the same if you were going down. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is, without the residual sugar and the dextrins and all that, you're going to end up with a beer that's way too bitter. So while 30 IBUs may not taste like much in a, you know, an imperial stout or something, that can blow a smaller beer out of the water. On the other hand, so that's talking about bitterness. When you're talking about hop flavor and hop aroma, the sort of late boil additions or dry hopping, hop backing, all that stuff, I tend to stay just about as strong, if not even stronger, with those. Again, trying to get a lot of flavor in, trying to get a lot of character that's going to almost cover up for the fact that you're missing malt. Something else you might want to consider is doing hop bursting or just all weight hop additions. Since you don't need many IBUs, you might be better off adding your first hop addition, say, at 15 or 20 minutes from the end, where it's still going to contribute a little bit more flavor and aroma.
So you get a mix of bitterness and aroma that way, right?
Exactly. And then just keep finishing out. And you could try first word hopping. A lot of these techniques that allow you to really maximize the amount of flavor you're getting. I also find with the weight hop additions that the amount of bitterness you get, it's for the IBUs, it's a little bit smoother. And that can be great in a session beer where you're looking for something that has a really sort of smooth, clean bitterness. Similar thing, you might want to choose hop varieties that aren't known for really sharp flavors. So like leave the Chinook out. Maybe go with something like Magnum to bitter if you're just going with a beer that doesn't have much hop flavor or aroma. Something very smooth, low cohumulone, those sorts of things.
Now, is color a concern when you brew these really light beers? I mean, do you just target the same color that you would for the say the regular beer we were moving, or do you change the color as you scale it down to?
Just because you've got less malt in there, you're going to have a lighter colored beer. In most cases, I pretty much just ignore it. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that's going to make a big impact. What you could do if you were worried, you know, if some of these beers, particularly if you're doing a beer with a lot of wheat malt, it can get really pale. I mean, almost, you know, to the point of not being yellow anymore. Some people add a very tiny amount of a very dark malt, something like black malt, or again, the Carafa Specials. I mean, much less than 1%, you know, 0.5%, 0.25%, just enough to bring the color up a little bit. It really won't add any roasted character. If you were worried, you could do a cold steep, so you could crush them all, leave in room temperature water overnight, strain it, and then you could add that as just sort of a color extract to dial in exactly the right color that you wanted. The similar sort of tone, you could have some issues with head retention. Again, just talking about having less malt, and it's a lot of the great head retention in a beer comes from the proteins in the malt. So that's something to worry about. Again, you could add some wheat or something like that that has a little bit more protein to help you get good head retention. I think that's one of the more important things particularly if you're trying to give a really light session beer to someone who doesn't drink a lot of low gravity beers, is trying to get it similar to what they're used to. So trying to work around the problems that you might have from using less malt, doctoring up the recipe a little, enhancing things to meet those challenges.
Now, do you change the mass schedule to try and generate more body, or do you leave it sort of the way you might want a higher body with less alcohol, for example.
No, that's definitely something I do. In a lot of cases, you'd want to raise the sacrification rest into the mid to high 150s. Mm-hmm. Not everyone does that. Some people like a real dry, and particularly if you're talking a middle of the summer beer, somewhere where it's really hot, you might want a real light, dry, crisp beer. For me, though, particularly if you're pushing the alcohol range really low, say below 3%, I definitely suggest going with a sacrification rest on the high side. And even up to 160, you're still going to get fine conversion. It doesn't take nearly as long to convert that temperature, so I mean, you may even just have a half an hour mash be enough. If you're an extract brewer, sort of similar deal, except you'd want to use a less fermentable extract. Try to find, if you've got some experience with some different brands, pick one that tends to have lower attenuation, and then you'll get that same sort of effect where you have a little bit more sweetness, a little bit more body left at the end. One of the things people don't realize when they talk about final gravity is final gravity really is sort of tricks you a little bit. The more alcohol you have, since alcohol is lighter than water, the lower the gravity will seem. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the last double IPA I did started at about 1094, ended up with about 10.5% alcohol, and the final gravity was 1014. If you take away that alcohol, the final gravity would actually be 1028. Mm-hmm. So it's half of the final gravity was sort of hidden by the alcohol, whereas right. If you do like this light IPA I'm drinking, finished about the same gravity, about 1014, but started at 1030 or 1029 mm-hmm. or so. And as a result, that one only has a couple of points hidden. So it's actually a much drier beer, even though in this case, the attenuation the yeast got is just over 50%. It's about 52 or 53%.
Versus say 70 something percent for a normal beer. Right?
The double IP, I think, was 85%. Hmm. And so even though that had, 30 something percent more attenuation, it was still a much sweeter beer because of all that alcohol and all of that residual body.
So I guess follow-up question, would you actually think about targeting a yeast maybe to, the one that doesn't attenuate quite as highly for one of these beers?
That would definitely be a great idea, and particularly for, say, an extract brewer who didn't have as much control. I love Safale's US05, it is, I think, too attenuative to use in a really low gravity beer. It really chews down the gravity. It chews up the body. The Fuller strain, I believe it's White Yeast 1968 or White Labs 002, is terrific. It's a lousy attenuator. It'll drop bright within a couple of days, and that's a great strain. A lot of the Belgian strains tend to be a little more finicky. So, I mean, it's a little more risky. So if you're worried that your beer is going to ferment out too much, you could consider crash cooling the beer midway through fermentation when the profile reaches what you want. The risk there is, since you're not letting the yeast clean up any diacetyl or acetaldehyde they've made, you may get some off flavors. So you're a lot better off controlling fermentability either with the yeast strain, with your choice of the yeast strain, or by mash and grain bill considerations, more crystal malt, more caramel malt, getting more unfermentables that way. If you're an extract brewer, another trick you can use is adding maltodextrin powder or lactose, and those work. Either you can add them up front, or I think the sort of the more reliable way is to let the beer ferment out, and if it gets too dry, if it doesn't have enough body, enough sweetness, add them back. And then you can add to taste right bottling, since they're unfermentable, or right to the keg after you carb it up if you want to taste it with the carbonation. I think carbonation is another important thing too. Mm-hmm. Really flat beer or really super carbonated beer to my palate anyway, makes something taste a little bit thinner. There can be some debate and some argument on what the right level is, but generally sort of the moderate carbonation helps to make the beer feel a little bit fuller, but not so spritzy that it, evaporates off your tongue.
Now, we've been talking all the way along here about actually designing a session beer. But traditionally, a lot of session beers were actually made from the second runnings of a fuller body beer or a full powered beer, if you will. Can you sort of walk us through that process, which a lot of people call party guile brewing?
Sure. And this is sort of the classic English way. And there are actually some really cool breweries that still do it. Fuller's, for example, in England, does from one mash, they get, I believe, four different beers. They get a barley wine, they get their ESB, they get London Pride, which is their special bitter, and they get their real small bitter. What they do is they run off the first runnings, and that's their really sort of thick, you know, sweet liquor. Same way that most brewers batch sparge, you then, you know, close it up, reinfuse your mash, and run off your second runnings. Now, sort of traditionally, this was done in three parts. So you get sort of strong, medium, and really light. What Fuller's does is they only take two, and then they blend them together in different ratios. So, for example, the barley wine is I believe, all or at least very close to all of the first runnings. The bitter is all or very close to all of the final runnings. And then the other two are different ratios. I think this is a great way to do it if you want sort of two or more different beers, is to run them off separately, and then you can take the gravities on each and then adjust what you're doing based on the gravity you get. The sort of rule of thumb I've always used is that the first third of the runnings that you take out have about half of the gravity. So what I've done for a long time is done, say, 3 gallons of barley wine or something really strong off of a mash, and then 5 gallons of sort of a more moderate gravity. You can certainly go even, you know, lower than that. If you did 5 gallons of barley wine, you'd end up with 5 gallons of really low gravity. That would be sort of pushing the lower end of session ale. What you can do to sort of counter that, you can use more malt. You can assume a lower efficiency, so there's more sugar to be taken. And when you think about how cheap malt is, you know, particularly if you're buying in bulk, something like that, it really isn't that much more effort to throw a few extra pounds in there, you know, a couple extra bucks worth of malt, and really get a better beer out of it as a result. So that's sort of one take on it, that you sort of can do multiple beers in the same sort of style and the same sort of family. But then you can sort of take it in a completely different direction. For example, Hair of the Dog, which is a great brewery out in Portland, Oregon, makes most of their living off of these big, bold beers. They do a barley wine called Fred, a big, dark smoke beer called Adam. And for their tasting room, they also do second running beers off of those. They're these sort of smaller session beers that don't have nearly sort of that big, bold character. But it's really easy for them because essentially they're free beers because the malt's already being used. You don't want to have to run off all of that wort and boil it down for 5 or 6 hours to concentrate it. So normally they just throw that out, but now they get to keep it. If you're worried about one of the big problems with party guiles, the second running beer tends to taste thinner and to taste lighter than the gravity would suggest. And that's a big problem with session beers, because you end up with a beer that, you know, tastes even less than 3% alcohol. And that's sort of the opposite of what you want. So the classic English answer to this is called capping. So after you run off the first beer, you might stir back in a half pound of crystal malt, something like that. Something that doesn't need to be converted, something that has sugars already available. You could use darker malt, say, if you want to run off a barley wine, and then dark mild. Stir it up, reinfuse your water, let it sit for 10 or 15 minutes, and then run off again.
So you're doing that in the mash tun, right?
Exactly, in the mash tun. You actually could, in the same way that an extract brewer steeps specialty malts, you could actually run it out and then steep some specialty malts in it too. And that would maybe be a better answer if you want the big beer to be dark, or you want the big beer to have a certain character that you didn't want in the smaller beer. Mm-hmm. What a lot of people do, I think sort of what the ideal is for these real low gravity beers, is a no sparge. So really assuming junky efficiency, adding more malt, but then running off and then not sparging at all. And the idea there is sort of the opposite of the party guile. You get more body, more malt flavor, a richer character. It's not as sort of fun and free as doing a second runnings beer, but I think it gives you, you know, a better result, and particularly if you wanted to do something that, say, wasn't hop forward at all, that, you know, something that was really sort of malty, say a mild, say a low gravity Dunkel or a Helles or something like that. This is also a good time to talk about sparging. Mm-hmm. In a low gravity beer like this, you want to be really careful that you're not extracting tannins. So be very careful, because the runnings coming out of the mash, say you fly sparge, are going to be really light. The pH has a tendency to go up. You tend to get tannins. And these small beers, there's nowhere to hide. There's no real character to hide behind. And so you end up with beers that can really taste rough on your tongue, can taste, you know, inappropriately bitter, can just be unpleasant to drink.
If I remember right, tannins come from oversparging, right? Primarily.
Exactly. And so when you're dealing with a smaller beer, it's a lot easier to oversparge because there's less sugar to take out of the mash. So watch your temperatures. You might consider acidifying your sparge water with phosphoric acid. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think the best answer is something like batch sparging or no sparging, where essentially you're not risking that slow drop in runnings gravity or mash pH, where you're just sort of infusing it all at once, and then you can drain it all off. Not a bad idea that if you're doing that to have some extra water on hand or some extra malt extract, just if you need to doctor things, you know, add a little bit of gravity or water it down a tiny bit, things like that.
Those are good suggestions. In fact, we did an episode on both batch sparging and sort of the party guile, various party guile approaches a while back. I think it was last spring.
There are a lot of things you can do in the mash that really, you can really have some fun.
Actually, the episode we did on sort of the party guile approach, making multiple batches from one beer, they walked through variations I'd never even heard of where they walk. It turns out you can split the batch almost anywhere and mix and match it afterwards, too. So make all kinds of interesting combinations.
Yeah, and the great thing about doing a small beer from that is I love putting a barley wine away that I'm not going to be drinking for 6 months maybe, but then you also get this beer that it will be ready in 2 or 3 weeks. That's one of the great things about session beers. They ferment really quickly. They're great fresh. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest problems with buying them is, and I think that's why a lot of commercial craft brewers don't do it. They don't tend to age very well. And the lower alcohol you have, it's less preservative. So they get infected easier with wild yeast or microbes or whatever. They tend to stale faster. So these are beers that really are ideal for making at home, where you are getting to control the whole process. You can get cold right after it's carbonated, and you can just enjoy it, fresh, mm-hmm. when it's still, good and delicious.
So don't give it too much time to age, huh?
Exactly. I mean, for the most part, certainly a lager or something like that, you might want to age out for, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, something like that. But you wouldn't want to give it a 6 month lagering like you might a Doppelbock or something.
So a lot of people tend to brew these session beers sort of off the cuff too, using what I would call the kitchen sink approach, which is basically, whatever you got laying around the shop, that's what you throw in the pot to brew with. Can you sort of talk about that approach as well?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is often not sort of an ideal approach if you really are just sort of grabbing things randomly and tossing them in. I do think there are a lot of times, though, when these sort of weird combinations of things can work really well. A couple, probably 2 years ago, I did an English brown ale that I hopped with Nelson Savin, the New Zealand hop. And this great sort of piney, resiny character on top of those toasty, bready, chocolatey, coffee kind of malts. The idea is you want to really think about what characters you're meshing together, not just loading in more malts because you have them, but really thinking what each malt's going to contribute, what sort of finish profile you want. I did a pale ale with oats, and that's sort of what I was talking about earlier. Adding ingredients that you have around, Quaker oats work fine, and then Palisade hops. And just these sort of combinations that work well, but that aren't, really aggressive, really aren't overdone. I mean, you can, I've done Imperial Stouts with 11 or 12 ingredients. I think when you give a beer a lot of time to age out, sometimes those flavors really can come together beautifully in a pale, small beer that you're drinking young. You don't want to go overboard with a lot of these ingredients. It really won't have time to come together, and you're not going to be happy with the results.
So you're saying simplicity is really important here, trying to Yeah, I know a lot of beginners tend to sit down and you know, put everything but the kitchen sink in there. You know, if they make a porter or whatever, for example, they'll put 10 different kinds of grain in there. But I think you make some fantastic beers with just maybe one or two specialty grains if you actually think about it.
I agree. I think that's especially true of these smaller beers. And then you don't even have to stick with the same sort of family of beers you're doing. So, for example, I did off of an English barley wine mash, I did a pale, hoppy German session lager. And so you don't have to necessarily be boxed in by, you know, what you think of the beer, you know, what the malts normally are used for, because it's going to be less malty because you're using a lot less, you know, less aggressive flavors. And as a result, that those sort of light, toasty flavors that came through from Maris Otter and Munich and whatever else I had in that barley wine were great in this like 4% beer.
So, Mike, I get this question quite a bit. A lot of people ask me, you know, how do you actually brew a low-calorie beer if you're not actually targeting a session beer, but you actually want something that is low-calorie? How do you go about designing one of those?
A lot of the things are going to be very similar. Again, this doesn't have to be something where it's going to be no flavor, low flavor. There can be some great sort of craft, you know, homebrew things that aren't, you know, Bud Light, something like that. One of the keys is you want to start with a really low gravity, say 1030, 1025, something like that. And part of that is we're going to be aiming for really high attenuation, you know, having the yeast consume basically all of the carbohydrates or all, you know, all that they can. And that's going to create more alcohol than you'd normally get. I mean, so as a general rule of thumb, 1030 beer, you'd expect to be around 3% alcohol. Well, if you get the yeast to eat down close to 1.000, it's going to be closer to 4% alcohol. So really, everything we do is about getting that lower final gravity. The primary thing, if you're an all-grain brewer, is going to be a low mash temp. And a lower mash temp is going to have beta amylase, which is the enzyme that converts a lot more maltose, mm-hmm. rather than sort of the random dextrin cutting of alpha amylase. And that works in the lower 140s especially well. So say 143, 144, something like that. And you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. Beta amylase takes its time. It just sort of clips one maltose at a time. And so 60 minutes, that's sort of the standard, you know, homebrew mash, may not be enough time. After 60 minutes, you might check, do an iodine test to see if the starches are all consumed. That can be a little misleading because while the starches might be gone, you still have dextrins there that the yeast won't be able to ferment that will leave calories, body behind. So really 90 minutes, even 120 minutes wouldn't be outlandish. So you've got this really fermentable wort. As a result, you're going to, since you're not going to have much sweetness, go real easy on the hops, easier than you would otherwise because that sweetness isn't there to balance them. Easy on the roasted malts, especially, you know, the really harsh, the black patent or anything like that. If you're an extract brewer, I would sub out 10, 15, maybe 20% of your fermentables for a simple sugar. You know, rice solids, corn syrup, brewer's corn syrup, not the Cara stuff. That's not what you want to be using. Glucose, sucrose, anything that the yeast will really easily be able to eat. The problem with that is, as we were saying earlier, takes away from much character. So while you'll be drying out the beer, you're really not going to be adding much to it in terms of flavor. I know some people, after they're done with fermentation, so we'll talk about that first, I guess. This is when the US05, another really attenuated strain, would be the best choice. Some of the Belgian strains even, something like Y-East 3711, the French Saison, will eat pretty much anything. Again, you're trying to get, you know, all those carbohydrates out. If, say, for example, your beer stops at 1010 or 1008, and you want lower than that, you can add an enzyme like Beano, and that is an enzyme which will break down any of the dextrins into simple sugars and will facilitate further fermentation. I've never played with Beano. I have a couple of friends who have and swear that it works and it, you know, it's pretty effective.
I can't say I've ever used Beano in my beer, no.
Now, I guess the risk there is that I've heard from some people that it can keep working. And so even once you think, you know, it's at 1.000, it'll keep going below that, you know, slowly working, and can cause problems with bottling unless you really give it enough time.
Probably a good thing to keg at that point, right? Because you got much more control over it.
That would be a good idea.
You don't want bottles exploding in your garage or something.
Exactly. So, it can be done with sort of any style. It tends to be those paler layer styles because you don't have much to balance anything out. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good point to mention, too, that corn and rice added to the mash really don't help fermentability as much as sort of people make them out to. The same enzymes are working on the starches in those corn and rice, and you're actually getting a lot of the same fermentability profile. What they're really there for is to lighten the malt flavor, to reduce the protein content for the brewers who are using 6-row malt.
Right.
So it's not necessarily commercial brewers, something you need to do.
Don't commercial brewers use a lot of rice and corn?
Yeah, the big boys, the Budweisers and the Millers. And,
right, because it doesn't add a lot of flavor, really, to the beer. It just
exactly. So that's lightening the flavor, which can be a benefit in a beer that you want to be light and crisp and, you know, easy to drink. I tend to favor a beer that has as much character packed into the alcohol and the, you know, as I can. But I mean, that's not what everyone wants. And some people, you know, Budweiser and Bud Light are some of those popular beers in the country, or the most popular beers in the country. So.
Well, Mike, we're actually running out of time now, but I wanted to thank you for being on the show. And I wondered, is there anything else you'd like to add? Is there any topics we may have missed as we walk through this?
Let me think. I think we hit almost everything. One of my favorite things about low-gravity beer is how well it goes with food. I find that the real strong stuff, when I drink it with food, I get the alcohol coming out more. I think, I'm not sure if it's that something's on my palate or it's reacting something. These low-gravity beers are just terrific, whether you're having a barbecue or whether you're just, you know, having dinner. They tend to, you know, if they're packed with flavor, you can drink a couple of them. You can just sort of enjoy yourself, not worry that you're going to knock down a couple of beers without paying attention. And these are really the best beers to brew at home, because really you can't get a lot of great session beers commercially. I mean, there's a few available, Anchor Small Beer, a few others, but for the most part, you know, maybe a local brew pub has one, but these are beers that are sort of the epitome of brewing at home, traditional, or, you know, whatever you want to brew. And I love the crazy stuff, but it's a lot of fun.
Well, it's appropriate to mention that, because we just came off an episode. The last episode was actually with Sean Paxson, who is the homebrew chef, and he talked quite a bit about how to mix food with beer.
Sean's a great guy. I'll have to go back and listen to that episode.
He's also very tall. Have you met him?
He is.
He is huge.
I met him in San Francisco a couple of years ago. We hung out. We'd trade beers a couple of times. But yeah, he's an imposing figure.
He sure is. Well, thank you again, Mike, for being on the show. Really appreciate you coming on and talking about session beer.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
So this week again, my guest was Mike Tonsmeyer, a.k.a. The Mad Fermentationist, and you can visit his blog at themadfermentationist.com. Well, thank you for listening to this week's Beersmith podcast, and also thank you to More Beer for sponsoring the podcast. You can express your thanks if you go to beersmith.com/morebeer and place an order there. Also, if you have feedback for us, you can leave a message at the form at beersmith.com/form. There's an actual section for the podcast. Or you can drop us a note at beersmith.com/blog under this episode. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.